Well, thank you very much. I must say these are the best introductions I've ever heard anywhere, excluding my own. But you've obviously done your research, and it's fantastic. It's also been a great meeting. Thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me. I've really enjoyed the talks. I'm impressed by the fact that it looks like neuroanatomy is making a comeback in a serious way, that maybe the direction of neuroscience will swing away from the molecular path it's been taken for the last 20 years, and people will start to look at what is really important in trying to understand the brain, which is relating the function to the structure, and the structure is the anatomical shapes of the nerve cells and their connectivity patterns. And that, I hope these fantastic new techniques that I heard about on Monday will really lead us seriously in that direction. So this is a picture of Vancouver where I live. Vancouver is over there. These little dots are people sailing and sailing boats. This is the Strait of Georgia. These apical dendrites peeking up at the bottom there are part of the numerous enormous trees that grow in the region. This is the University of British Columbia in this peninsula here. There's a kind of fog hanging over the university, which is usual, and you can see Vancouver Island in the distance. And above me, people are probably skiing, and below me, there are probably other people skateboarding and windsurfing and doing all sorts of physical activities. So I'm going to talk about three possibly or apparently different things: visual cortex maps, feedback connections, and apical dendrites. And I'm going to try and connect these three things in a theory about what feedback is doing. So this is a kind of prevailing view of the organization, the visual system, the David Van Essen and John Mansell hierarchical organization. And there are sort of different ways people think about vision, but one of them is a very sort of simplistic way where things come in at the bottom through the retina, they go up through the LGN to the V1, they go up to V2 and so forth, and then they sort of percolate up and they emerge at the top. And actually what's at the top in this diagram is the hippocampus, but it's the feed-forward model of visual processing, and it just says that things kind of flow upwards and get progressively sort of filtered out into different categories, and vision works like that. And against that view, there's a different one, which was advanced by Richard Gregory many, many years ago and others, that vision is really an active process where the brain is constantly constructing hypotheses about the world and then simply comparing the inputs that it gets against its own ideas about what should be there. And that's a kind of top-down model where basically vision starts at the top with your model of the world and you sort of percolate back downwards and compare what's coming up with what you expect to see. What we can say about this diagram is the connections are certainly, they're two-way. There's whenever you get a connection going up, there's always a connection going back down. We can also say it's a very complicated system. It's certainly much more complicated than this diagram indicates. And an initial thought is that whenever you have a complex system that's sending messages to between different parts, it's not a very good idea to send messages without checking that they've actually been received correctly. And in every other part of the body that I know about, whenever a signal is sent out, there's always some kind of feedback signal that comes back, which allows the thing that's trying to do the controlling to know what's happening at the other end. It's a basic engineering principle. I think it's very unlikely that in a system like the cortex, you would send messages out without some kind of system for checking whether the message has been received correctly. And an obvious way of doing that is to send a copy of the message back to the thing that sent it, and the thing that sent it can then compare that copy with the thing it sent and see whether it's the same. And if it is, then it can proceed on the assumption that the message has been received correctly. And so that idea is the basis for what I'm going to be speculating about. So the feedback pathways, we've known about them for a long time. Kathy Rockland is going to talk about the anatomy of feedback connections in her talk, so she will have more to say about it than I will. But one, we can say that they're usually there, they're ubiquitous in the brain. They're often much more numerous than the feed-forward connections between two structures. The very important point is that they conduct as rapidly as the feed-forward connections, and that's significant because rapid conduction velocity implies large axons, which implies a large commitment of volume of the brain to the pathway, which means it must be functionally very important, that it's doing something very quickly. So these things are likely to be active all the time during normal cortical activity. Right. Right, well, another issue is how far the axons spread, and of course, since when they spread, they're usually quite small, conduction velocity may get lower, but the important point is that the conduction velocities in the backward direction are as fast as they are in the forward direction, and the brain wouldn't do that unless it needed them to be as fast, so it suggests that feedback processing is critical to the normal millisecond level operation of events in the brain. They often have wider tangential distributions than the feed-forward projections to an area. The anatomical distribution in V1 particularly can be patchy. Amir Shmuel has done experiments where he's labeled particular axonal projections or feedback connections and found that they can have a patchy distribution where the patches match the distribution of orientation preferences in the underlying map. There's evidence that feedback is necessary for events in V1 to reach conscious perception. Experiments involving transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, have been used to show that. So that feedback may be important for a conscious perception of stimuli as well as unconscious perception. So various ideas that people have had about the functions of feedback pathways. The one that I sort of picked up when I was younger is that they have a kind of slow modulatory role, which doesn't, of course, fit with the fast conduction velocities. An idea that's come from theoreticians like Stephen Grossberg and David Mumford is that they, their job is to model the feed-forward, the pattern of feed-forward activity, and that's the idea I will use. Another closely related idea is that they might predict what stimulus is going to come next, not what's there right now, but what's about to happen. And following on from that is another idea which I quite like, which is that the role of feedback is to cancel the pattern of feed-forward activity. In other words, it's kind of negative feedback. That if you can predict what's coming, you can cancel out its activity, and you can thereby reduce the overall level of activity in the brain. And I like that idea because, if correct, it would suggest, I mean, Simon would like it, of course, because it's going to be metabolically favorable. It also suggests that the goal of the brain is to minimize its own activity level, which suggests that the sort of energy function for the brain is just zero activity. If you can, in the face of an unpredictable world, if you can minimize your brain activity, then you're doing a good job of understanding what's out there in the world. Unfortunately, the idea doesn't really seem to be correct, because as far as anybody knows, we can tell the feedback connections are always excitatory to the cells that they connect with. Another idea is that they sort of are silent during the day, but they're active at night during dreams when you're perhaps reconstructing things, so they have a separate, they're just not active during normal perception. More sophisticated ideas coming from more recent modeling is that they sort of code the prior probability of the stimulus of something happening, which is very closely related to the idea of prediction. They can obviously mediate top-down attentional effects. We know that you can selectively attend to different regions of the visual field, and of course, feedback is likely to be important in doing that. Questions? Right. No, not as far as I know, but it's just an idea. So I remember questions being asked about physiologists about what they thought feedback was doing, and they thought, well, it's, as far as we can tell, it's not doing anything. Which suggests that maybe when the animal's asleep, it's doing something. It's, you know, possible. Feedback, say, for example, from V2 to V1, I'm mostly thinking about feedback between different cortical areas. Of course, there's feedback within the single cortical areas that layer 2 feeds back, you know, projects back down to layer 5. Whether you call that feedback or feed forward depends on what do you think about the organization of the different layers of the cortex. So what the ideas I'm going to propose are not related to that kind of rather local kind of feedback. Right. Okay. So, from what I'm going to say, you can probably ignore the definition, but the way I think about it is in the context of the Van Essen-Mansell hierarchical scheme. When you make me realize that. So, when you look at the patterns of connections between different cortical areas, you can distinguish those which seem to be feed forward, and those which seem to be going up in the hierarchy. That is, the connections will go from area 1 to area 2, predominantly to the middle layers of area 2, and then area 2 will project to area 1 in a different pattern of connections, where the connections go predominantly to the upper and the lower layers. And those connections have been characterized as feedback or going backwards in the hierarchy. And if you have that rule, you can establish a consistent hierarchy among the different areas of the cortex. So you can talk about the projections going as having a direction within the hierarchy. So I'm talking about projections that go backwards down the hierarchy. But in a more general sense, I don't have to be restricted by that. It's just a different class of projections, but they are functionally they are feedback because they're going to model what's coming in from below. I think they think the feedback. Most axons terminating on spines in the cortex release glutamate. That's the dogma, as I understand it. So the feedback projections would be releasing glutamate. They terminate on spines. I'm reasonably sure of that. Right. So the next component, apical dendrites. You all know what apical dendrites are. If you go to brainmaps.org and look at these silver neurofilament stain sections, you see beautiful pictures of pyramidal cells, and you get a. This will help perhaps to reinforce the impression that apical dendrites are a major structural feature of the cortex. They're ubiquitous. As far as I know, nobody has come up with any good reason for why cells would need to have apical dendrites, and yet they're the outstanding structural feature of the cortex. This is a drawing from Cajal, so you can see the basal dendrites there and the apical dendrite running all the way up to layer one. And the cells, pyramidal cells, will have an apical dendrite that runs through all the layers up to layer one. What this is telling us is this cell really likes to be in this particular position in the cortex. In other words, it wants to get input from precisely that point in the cortex. And that's different from the basal dendrites, which want to get input from a somewhat larger region. So the apical dendrite really tells you that, in a sense, that maps are important, that is, that the position of that cell in the cortex really matters. So within a precision of like 30 microns or so. So maps in the cortex. I assume you're all familiar with the different kinds of maps that we see in V1. There's a retinotopic map. Superimposed upon it is an ocular dominance map, where white represents one eye, black represents the other, with a period of alternation of about a millimeter. There are maps of orientation preference. We have color codes for the orientation of the preferred orientation of the region. Again, there's a periodicity of roughly a millimeter. In cat visual cortex, probably monkey as well, there's a map for spatial frequency. Mark Hubner, colleague, showed that. There's also maps for direction preference. So there are maps, and these maps can be overlaid on top of each other. Here's just an example of that. This is taken, again, from Mark Hubner's work in cat optical imaging experiments, where he was able to determine the ocular dominance map in a particular area of cortex, and in the same region, the spatial frequency map, and also the orientation map. And then when you color code these and overlay them, you get this representation, which I call a polymap, where different colors, each particular color, codes for some unique combination of orientation and ocular dominance and spatial frequency. And you can see that these different colored regions are distributed in a more or less sort of uniform way across the surface of the cortex. So the cortex is superimposing these maps in ways that allows it to permute all the features in as uniform a way as it can, given the dimensionality of the space. And there's an important assumption which underlies the concept of separable maps for it's often taken for granted, but I think people are becoming more aware of it now, which is that the maps are really no more than the tuning properties of the individual cells within them, but sort of writ large across the surface of the cortex. So that in order to talk about separable maps, you have to assume that you can, for each single cell, you can independently establish the best value of a particular property independently of all the others. That is, you have to be able to establish a preferred orientation that's independent of the ocular dominance value of the cell, or independent of the particular spatial frequency that you use to stimulate it, or independent of the particular region in visual space within the cell's receptive field that you use to stimulate it. So those things have to be independent, and that's a property of the individual receptive fields of those cells. And it turns out that you usually can write the receptive field of a cell as a separable, a product of tuning functions for different individual parameters. And for example, you might write tuning curve for a cell where X and Y are the positions in visual space, theta is the preferred orientation. You can write that as a product of three Gaussians and you get a reasonably good estimate or description of the cell's receptive field properties. But that separability allows you to establish the best value of one parameter independently of all the others, and that's what allows you to talk about separable maps, maps of spatial frequency that are separable and overlaid on top of the orientation map, overlaid on top of the optical dominance map, etc. And this assumption of separability is critical for what I'm going to suggest to you. So supposing you try and calculate in the cortex a pattern of activity that will be generated by a particular small stimulus. For example, here, a bar with an orientation, a vertical bar seen through the right eye with a high spatial frequency. Not a bar, I mean a little Gabor patch. The way you can calculate that pattern of activity is by taking the appropriate ocular dominance map, that is the ocular dominance map for the right eye, which I think would be the white regions in the upper figure there, taking the spatial frequency map for high spatial frequencies, which I think might be the white regions, I'm not sure, and taking the orientation map that you'd get for a vertical stimulus, that is, you find the calculate the regions of activity in this map that were the regions in that map that were responsive to a vertical bar. You would take those three patterns and then you multiply them together, and then you will then get the predicted pattern of activity. You multiply them together with the cortical point image, which is the receptive field size, the retinal receptive field size of the cells involved. You multiply those three things together and you will get this predicted pattern of activity in the cortex there. And you'll see that it's patchy. And that's a general feature, general thing that emerges, that you would predict that a particular stimulus, any particular small stimulus, is going to evoke not just localized regions of activity in the cortex, but a more or less complicated pattern of patches patches of activity in the cortex. But the important thing is that you can get this by multiplying these simpler patterns together. This is just a prediction, but there is experimental data that supports it. So this is in a different area. This is a face area of monkey temporal cortex, and this is an experiment done by Wang and Tanifuji. They did optical imaging, and you show face stimuli to the monkey, and you typically get, for any particular stimulus, you typically get several small patches of activity distributed across the surface of the cortex. So again, you get this sort of patchy distribution of activity rather than single spots. And these are predictions I've made from more models of more complex kinds of feature spaces that might be represented in maps. This is a simulated map for a four-dimensional orientation space plus a retina. And these are the patterns of activity that you get when you present against simulated small oriented bars at particular patterns of orientation, particular stimuli at particular positions. And you get these very complex patterns of activity across the surface of the cortex. So the question is, how would higher areas decode this kind of pattern of activity in order to determine what was there? The pattern is very complicated, and it's not easy to think of simple feedforward mechanisms that would do the decoding. I mean, you can think of mechanisms, and they presumably are there, but it doesn't seem like a straightforward problem to solve geometrically. So I'm going to suggest that the way the brain does this kind of thing is to generate a hypothesis about the stimulus. That is, it tries to model the spatial pattern of activity caused by the feedforward stimulus. And feedforward fibers acting in combinations can do this in an efficient way. So feedback is trying to model the pattern of activity that's coming up through the feedforward projections. And this is not, as I said, a new idea. It's one of the few possible things I would think that feedback could actually do. But it can do this in a very simple kind of way, or an economical kind of way. So this is just an example, a simplified example of doing this. So this is a representation of a sort of simplified, a small region of cortex. There's an orientation map and there's a retinotopic map there. Supposing you want to code 10 possible positions along azimuthal positions in the retina, so 10 possible positions in this direction, and you want to code 10 possible positions in this direction, and you want to code 10 possible orientations. So that gives you a total of 1,000 possible stimuli. And there are 1,000 possible patterns of activity that you might get on the cortical surface when you do that. So the question is, can you model each of these 1,000 patterns of activity in some combinatorial way by feedback projections? So supposing you have a feedback projection whose distribution of activity in the cortex looks like this. This is a bit hypothetical, but supposing it has a distribution and a line along this with a spread, a Gaussian spread, which is determined by the, which is essentially a receptive field width in visual space. You have this pattern of activity corresponding to this particular hypothesized retinal position. Then in the other dimension, in the y dimension, elevation dimension, you have another fiber projecting backwards, and its distribution pattern looks like that, in that direction. It's coding for this possible position in retinal elevation. And then you have another set of fibers that's coding for this particular orientation. It has a distribution that looks like that, which corresponds to the distribution of orientation preference in the cortex. So if you can multiply the activities of all the, of these three fibers together, you will get a pattern which looks like that, which is exactly the feed-forward pattern. So to do that, you need a total of 30 feedback projections. You need 10 of these fibers, 10 of these, and 10 of these. So you're able to decode 1,000 patterns with 30 fibers. So in general, you can decode x to the power n. N is the dimensionality of the map. So here we have a three-dimensional map, but in general, we think the dimensionality may be much higher than that. X is the number of possible values that you might want to code along each dimension. This is something that might vary depending on the importance of the thing that the brain was interested in. But in general, you have n to the x to the power n feed-forward patterns, and you can decode them in this combinatorial way with nx fibers. So there's an economy of scale there, which is important. Right, right. So if you didn't care very much about resolution, you could make the distribution of activity in the fibers much broader. If you cared a lot, you could make it narrower. If you didn't care about certain orientations, you could simply not have feedback fibers for those orientations. It depends on, it totally depends, I guess, on what you think might be important functionally. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter for the formulation of the model, but right. If you didn't care very much about the where things were, then x could be very small. If you cared a lot about where things were, then x could be much smaller. There will be some limits on how the usefulness of making x very small, because there are limits on how accurately you can decode patterns depending on the receptive field widths of the cells in the feed-forward pathway. Right, so the feed-forward pattern, I'll get to this, but the feed-forward is just the pattern of activity in the cells in the map that is coming in, as I imagine, coming in through the basal dendrites. It might be the level of depolarization of cells. It might be their actual spiking activity, but it's the activity that we know is produced in, say, in primary visual cortex by stimuli coming in. So the feed-forward is the incoming sensory stimulus. So in this example, it's a small bar of light in a particular position in the visual field. The feedback is modeling, is the brain generating a hypothesis which says there is a small bar at this position in the visual field, and I want to test whether it's there or not. This is coming back, I'll show you this in the next slide, this is coming back somehow. It's coming back to the same area where the feed-forward pattern of activity is. So maybe this will be clear in the next slide. Sorry, what if you have one? That's more slightly more complicated. Right. In general, this is a setting for very simple kinds of decoding where you're talking about one very small stimulus, you know, which is not realistic. So in general, you're looking at more complicated things. But if you assume the distribution of features across the visual field is sparse, which it probably is, then it can probably cope with this. First of all, our brains cannot cope very well with overlapping features. So you can attend to one but not the other. If you superimpose a picture of a house and a face, for example, you'll see either the face or the house. When you see the face, the house's pattern is going to be inhibited and you won't see it very well. So there you have overlapping contours, and some of them are being selected by higher level attentional mechanisms. and others are being repressed because they don't fit with your construction of a face, for example. So you repress the contours of the house, and that's exactly the kind of behavior you'd get from a mechanism like this. So in order to do this in order to predict or reconstruct the pattern of feedforward activity, you have to combine these activities in the feedback connections very locally. Ideally, you just multiply them. So apical dendrites are an obvious candidate for doing that kind of very local reconstruction. So this is another kind of setting of the model, if you like, which may give you a clearer idea of what I'm suggesting is going on. So this is, imagine you have a set of binary maps for three different binary features, and you can code 2^3 possible patterns there. And each of these feature domains is a little patch in the cortex. You can decode those by having feedback connections, each of which matches the individual patterns, the individual bit distributions of those patterns in the map. So you have three sets of branching fibers. And their regions of overlap correspond to conjunctions of those features, correspond to the occurrence of that particular pattern in the map. And so you can detect that conjunction by having an apical dendrite which passes through each of those three patterns and multiplies them together. So the apical dendrite is able to reconstruct the feed-forward pattern by multiplying the pattern of activity in the feedback fibers. Right, there's evidence that apical dendrites do multiplicative things, yes. Right. But in order to make the model work, it doesn't have to be you don't have to multiply things. I'll get to that. So is that... Okay, so assume there are these projections coming from somewhere, okay? They are feedback in the sense that they are trying to predict what's coming in from the sensory stimulus. But I don't have any very strong ideas about where they may actually be coming from. They might, for example, come from the thalamus. I can't predict where they're going to come from, but I'm suggesting that in order for you to do this job of modeling the pattern of feed-forward activity, this is a very simple and obvious way of doing it. And it takes advantage of the orthogonality property, the separability property of maps that allows you to exploit the reduce x to the power n possible patterns to nx combinations of activity, that is, nx axons, the total number of nx axons. Right. But the apical dendrite. So what's the question? These white regions in each of these three layers here, each of those is an axon, okay? Branch spreading widely and tangentially in the cortex with this kind of patchy distribution, which we know at least some of the feedback axons have. And then, in this particular simple example, it's a binary map, so you're looking for conjunctions of features, so it's doing a logical operation like a Venn diagram. So where the patterns overlap corresponds to all three things being true, if you like, or all three subfeatures being present, okay? Well, the apical dendrites run up through depending on where the cell body is, but they run up through it. But the important thing is that they integrate information at one tangential point in the map. So they can reconstruct the pattern of feedforward activity more accurately that way. You mean right, when you say the tuft, you mean the bit You mean this bit at the top? Right, so, okay, so I'm ignoring this bit. I'm well aware that most apical dendrites do that. When they get to layer one, they branch and they go much further tangentially. There may be a way of incorporating that into the theory if you don't care as much about the precise location in the map. That is, if you're prepared to lose resolution a bit, which you might. For the kinds of things I'm talking about, I'm assuming most of the integration is going to be going along this length of the dendrite. Sorry? Right, there are also branches that go off sideways, and they're a bit of a difficulty for the model because they would reduce the resolution of the reconstruction. Unless they branched off in very specific places, it might be possible to accommodate them. But it's a very simple idea, so I don't really... I mean, and of course there's much more detail in the real brain than, you know, is required by the idea. That's not surprising. But the important thing is, for the idea to work, it really depends on this extremely restricted part of the apical dendrite. And it has to integrate the information that it gets from widely spreading, tangentially spreading axons. So it would be a very difficult thing to test this particular thing experimentally, because you'd have to isolate the sources of the feedback projections, which would be very hard, so I don't envisage being able to do that very easily. What I would envisage being possible is perhaps with those sort of retrograde labeling techniques that I gather Ed Calloway was talking about, is that you could fill a pyramidal cell with the virus, I guess it's a virus, and then look at the distribution of all the axons that were connecting to its apical dendrite. And then you should find that those axons spread out in different ways across the surface of the cortex. They would have non-overlapping patterns. Right, it is. Right. Right. This is okay. So this is a slightly okay. So right. So if you wanted to produce this pattern of feed-forward activity in the first place, you could do that by having inputs which came in were simply the same as these ones. And as you say, it's a kind of they would just sort of cancel out. There wouldn't be much point in doing it. But I think you can extract these binary features or some other kinds of features in more complex ways than just summing up inputs. Thalamic inputs, presuming the cell is doing some kind of interesting logical operations on its inputs. The things that might emerge would not be simply predictable from the distribution of its inputs. Right, those things come from the feed-forward connections, but how they actually become separable and how they actually become things like orientation tuning and spatial frequency tuning is a much more complex function of the way the inputs arrive. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any need to do any of this, I agree. So you have to assume the basal dendrites are extracting in some way information from their inputs, which it's then expressed in this multidimensional feature space, which is mapped across the map, mapped across the surface of the cortex, which is what we know happens in V1, and probably other areas as well. And then the job of the rest of the brain, or one of its jobs, is to try and predict the feed those patterns of incoming activity. And I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest that that's going on, that kind of prediction is happening. So what is, and then given that the maps are separable, this is a simple way of doing it. And I realize that a lot of the idea, there's a lot else that is quite vague about this. But the main point is to make is that there is something to be gained by having apical dendrites integrating information within very narrow regions within a map in order to reconstruct the feed-forward pattern of activity, which is generated in a different kind of way. And that widely spreading patterns of feedback fibers are acting in combination are one of the things that ways in which you would do that. Right, that's a good question. I don't have an answer to it. So they have to factorize the input distributions. And I'm not sure how easy that is in a neural net. So in other words, you have to present it with patterns of activity, and it has to figure out what are the factorial dimensions of those. In other words, how to represent each of those patterns in terms of the product of a number of other simpler patterns. So I'm not sure how you might do that. So that's a good question. So is feedback active all the time? It may well be. So if you record from V1 optically and then area 17 in the cat, and then you cool area 18, the amplitude of the responses in V1 decreases, which is pretty much in line with what I would suggest. So in other words, feedback, this is the other part of the model, feedback doesn't seem to be doing anything terribly interesting. It's just scaling up the responses in V1 or wherever it's going to. So we'll get to that a bit. No, but it would be identical with this thing. It would look like this. Right. Well, through modeling, it doesn't have to multiply things for the model to work reasonably well. The reconstruction would be good enough if it simply added stuff. The multiplication is obviously a difficult thing to implement neurally, so I wouldn't assume that apical dendrites could do that. So I'll talk about that. So this is just a sort of structure of overview of the structure of the model. So this is where the feedback comes from some areas that I'm assuming there are other cortical areas, but it's not necessary to assume that. They come back here. Here is a cortical map. Here's an array of pyramidal cells. Here's a sort of hypothetical pattern of feed-forward activity. And here's the matching pattern of reconstructed activity in the feedback fibers. And then ideally what you want to do to make sure these patterns are the same is multiply them. This is just template matching. So the best way of doing that is to multiply these things together. And then if the patterns match, activity in this network will be at a maximum. If the patterns are different, there'll be activity will be less. So you measure that by simply summing the activity across all the cells with a type of cell I call a collector cell. This cell simply reports on the net amount of activity in the cortex. It's a kind of boring cell. It responds to everything. But it plays a very important role in this. It's not an essential part of the model, but I assume that you need something like this to make the model actually do something interesting. Then the collector neuron then projects forwards and tells you, essentially it's a match signal. So this is also very similar to trying to read out a content addressable memory. So in a content addressable memory, you send a copy of the thing that you think is in the memory to the memory. And if it's there, you get a match signal back. It says, yes, this is in the memory. If it's not, you don't get a signal. So this is also identical to a kind of content addressable memory mechanism. So you need to do various things. If you simply sent back lots of activity in the feedback projections, then of course you'd increase the activity in the cortex and you get the wrong kind of signal coming back. So the feedback, the hypotheses generated by the other areas need to be well constructed. That is, they need to be valid hypotheses about what's going on. I assume the brain has ways of dealing with that, but yes, that's another component of the mechanism which needs to be dealt with. But if you think something like this is going on, if you think feedback is reconstructing feed-forward activity, and you want to make the mechanism work, you have to have something like that, because otherwise you've got no idea whether the reconstruction is accurate or not. Right. So Right. You may be more interested in if it's right. So you can imagine a psychophysical experiment where, when I've simulated this, so I'll talk about it. you think that you're going to see a vertically oriented bar presented on the screen. So I imagine your brain is sitting there with some kind of model of what the stimulus looks like. Something flashes up on the screen, and your job is to say whether it was vertical or not. then that's a perfect example of that. If you don't get a proper match signal coming back, then you would say it's different. And if you do get a signal coming back, then you would say it was the same. You need to set the threshold appropriately for a, but this is your thing which can do visual psychophysics, if you like. So I tested three different kinds of models for integrating the input. So here, O is simply the activity at point IJ in the cortex. There's a threshold. AIJ is the activity, is the feed-forward activity in a cell. And these Qs here are the activities in the feedback fibers, which I call Q fibers, or Q for query. This is the activity in the nth Q fiber, n indexing the number of dimensions in the map, at point IJ in the cortex. So in this particular, this is the simplest kind of model where you simply add everything up. It's linear, and then you threshold it. So this is probably the most plausible physiological model that you could get. Another model I call the add-multiply model, where you, again, add things up in the apical dendrites, and then you multiply them with the activity in the basal dendrites. And there is physiological evidence that the apical dendritic input does have a multiplicative effect on the inputs coming from the basal dendrites. So this may be a plausible model. And this is what it seems likely to be the best model, where you simply multiply everything up. And then the collector response is simply given by the sum of all these individual cellular responses across some region of the cortex. So this is the collector response. S is the stimulus, some point in some high-dimensional feature space. H is the hypothesis, which is the brain's estimate of that point in the same space. So what you're looking at is the collector response is a function of S, the stimulus, and the hypothesis. And if the stimulus equals the hypothesis, then C is at a maximum. So one way in which the brain might estimate stimuli is by doing a search in this space and finding the hypothesis which gives the best match with the stimulus. I'm not all that keen on the idea of the brain doing iterative search because it's slow. You need to test lots of different combinations before you find the maximum. One thing that would speed it up, though, is you get this dimensionality reduction. So you have x to the power n possible stimuli, but you don't have to do x to the power n tests, you only have to do nx tests. And furthermore, because the space is separable, you can find the maximum separately along each of the dimensions. So you could find the maximum along one dimension, then go along the other dimension. And of course, that makes the optimization very much easier. However, in the tests that I did of the model, I assumed a much simpler kind of scenario where the brain simply generates a single hypothesis and then compares the activity against that which it actually got for a particular kind of stimulus. So when you do that, let me just explain this. This is the collector response as a function of the difference between the stimulus and the hypothesis. And when the stimulus equals the hypothesis, I did this for a simulated cortical map of orientation and retinopathy. So the activity, as you'd expect, is maximum along this diagonal line where the stimulus equals the hypothesis. But there's a bit of variation here, which is caused by structural irregularities in the map. And, that's what that diagram means anyway. And this is a distribution of a diagram showing the distribution of the values of the collector response, C, here, plotted against the difference between a particular orientation stimulus and the brain's hypothesized orientation stimulus. So each time, and you assume there's noise in everything, that is, there's noise in the responses of the cell, multiplicative noise. And you can also do this by presenting the stimulus at slightly different positions in the map, which is realistic, because when you present a stimulus to a human observer, the eye is not always going to be in exactly the same place, probably. So you will get slight variations in the amount of activity depending on where the stimulus actually is in the map. So if you plot the distribution of collector responses against the orientation differences here, you get this kind of graph here. And in order to detect that the orientation is different from the one you expect, the collector response has got to be reliably different from the response you'd get when the stimulus was the expected one. So you can define a kind of psychophysical, or something like a psychophysical threshold for the mechanism this way, where you say, what's the smallest orientation difference for which the collector response is going to be reasonably often less than the response it would give to the correct stimulus? So the conventional threshold chosen by psychophysicists is about 87 degrees, and 87% reliability, and I've chosen that. And you can use that to test the mechanism, test how well it can actually distinguish stimuli. And I probably should speed up. I'm supposed to be done by now. Right. So let me just quickly... So I talked about apical dendrites and the importance of doing the integration narrowly. So if you look, you measure the orientation thresholds in the way I talked about, and you simulate the effects of having more broadly distributed apical dendrites, you find the orientation thresholds increase quite significantly for relatively small amounts of apical dendritic spread, so more than about 30 microns, that your performance starts getting worse, which suggests apical dendrites really do need to be narrower than about 50 microns. So just to summarize, the things that go into this model are the idea that feedback pathways model their inputs, the separability of receptive fields, and the idea that some other part of the brain generates hypotheses in this way. What you get out is an explanation for apical dendrites. You predict that tuning curves in general should be multiplicatively scaled by things that are likely to represent top-down effects like attention, and indeed all the evidence suggests that attention multiplicatively scales tuning curves, which doesn't seem terribly interesting, or it's never struck me as being terribly interesting, but it fits perfectly with these kinds of ideas. There is evidence that I mentioned of multiplicative interactions between apical and basal dendrites, and the model suggests why it might be a good idea to do that. They're doing template matching, and it's best to multiply things when you want to see if they're similar. You get this breakdown of x to the power n to nx, that kind of economy. It explains the broad, sometimes patchy distribution of tangential distribution of feedback axons. So you would predict that there should be fibers like that found by Emir Schmuel in V1. And there are other aspects which I would talk about. There's another picture of Vancouver. Thank you.
Right. But it's playing the same role in your feedback model. Right. So it's making a prediction about what is going to be the effective and the input given that it might flat out on this time. And there's a lot of scientific experiments that explain this kind of cancellation that we're experiencing. So it's a beautiful paper by Daniel Wolfgang where he explains why it's very hard to tickle yourself. Some of you can tickle too, but you cannot tickle yourself because once you know that it's going to happen, it's going to be
Sorry, you think that feed forward projections from layer 4 would... Well, I don't know if... I don't know how certain that is. Right. But they may not necessarily connect with the apical dendrites in that region. They may connect with basal dendrites. But if they did connect predominantly with apical dendrites, that would be perhaps an embarrassment for the model, or that you'd need to find some other way of accommodating it. But, There's another fundamental distinction between the information in the feed forward and feedback in this scenario, which is very deep. So the feed-forward projections are a population code, a distributed code, because a single stimulus causes a distribution of activity, and the activity of any one cell is ambiguous. But the feedback projections are an explicit representation of the codes, and they have completely different properties from the feed-forward. And I didn't make that clear, but a signal in a feedback projection, this scenario, means precisely the occurrence of one particular subfeature generalized across all other features. And there's a very big difference between them.
And that's why we wanted them to be very localized.
Well, that's why I want them to be distributed, but then to be integrated locally.
Right.